Israeli settlers perform religious rituals at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds in a move that was banned decades ago. Britain disputes the French claim that London and Paris have reached a deal to defuse a row over post-Brexit fishing rights. And Russia reports nearly 41,000 new coronavirus infections, its highest single daily case tally since the start of the pandemic. I'm Marzia Hashimi. I appreciate you being with us. Well, the situation has been tense in the occupied Al-Quds during the past few hours after a group of Israeli settlers escorted by armed soldiers entered the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Now, local sources are telling us that dozens of settlers have entered there and entered the mosque. Our correspondent in Ramat Lamona Kandil explains why Palestinians see these visits as provocative and if Israelis are allowed to conduct prayers inside of the mosque silently or otherwise.
What happened this morning is that dozens of Israeli settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, protected by Israeli police officers. They toured the area there, and then, according to local sources, they performed their Jewish rituals there. It's forbidden for Israeli settlers to perform any of their prayers or any kind of prayers, even the so-called silent prayers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. And this has angered the Palestinians. Last month, there was a ruling by an Israeli court that allows the Israeli settlers to perform their silent prayers. However, after rejection and condemnation, anger reactions from the Islamic world, the Palestinians, and Jordan mainly, the Israelis said that they retreated back this decision. For the Muslims, it's a very important and sacred place. Palestinians, Muslims are allowed to pray there. Other religions can come and only visit, not inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but the complex of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, Palestinians are saying that settlers continue to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex almost on a daily basis, and some of them do not respect the agreements that these are only visits, not for the prayers. They pray there, they perform their silent prayers and their Jewish rituals, which is not allowed. That's why clashes continue to take place between Palestinians and Israelis in that area from time to time.
Meanwhile, Israel's tightened blockade on the Gaza Strip has minimized the chance of thousands of unemployed Palestinians looking for jobs in the occupied lands and the West Bank. This has led to an unprecedented rate of unemployment in the impoverished enclave. Rubit Shabbat brings us more.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians are lining up in front of the chambers of commerce across the Gaza Strip, hoping to get permits from the Israeli side to walk in the occupied lands and the West Bank. This comes after Ramer saying that more permits are set to be issued for the first time following the recent escalation on the Gaza Strip.
It is hard to believe that Israel is going to issue permits for us to work in occupied lands and the West Bank. Since 2019, no permission has been issued by Israel. We have been jobless since then. Now Israel says it is going to issue new permits, but it has set hard conditions for us.
In light of the deteriorating economic situation in Gaza with the high unemployment rate of more than 53% and poverty reaching about 70%, Palestinians hope to obtain the permits to find work opportunities in the occupied lands and the West Bank that will help them to reduce their poverty. Since Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005, It no longer allowed Gaza workers to obtain permits that would enable them to work, as tens of thousands of workers used to go out daily to walk in the occupied lands as their only source of income in the fields of construction, agriculture, industry, and tourism.
The Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip has led to an unprecedented level of unemployment in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, about 70% of Palestinian families suffer from lack of food, and this is all due to the collapse of Gaza's economy.
The Chamber of Commerce says Israel should be held accountable for the growing rate of unemployment in Gaza. The daily hardships endured by Palestinians, along with the crippling blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, led thousands to search for work opportunities outside Gaza. Palestinians called on the international community to end the siege and develop solutions to reduce high rates of poverty and unemployment. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Only a day after Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Tehran, the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal now sending yet another confusing signal. They're urging Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, the quartet is calling on Iran to, quote, change course. That's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year, but started cutting back on them in response to the U.S.'s abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it's ready to restart negotiations in late November, but wants to see the sanctions removed as an outcome of the talks. Washington, though, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions just 2 days ago, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House's claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement. Well, Iran has cast doubt about the seriousness of the United States in rejoining that nuclear deal. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says if the U.S. is serious about rejoining the agreement, President Joe Biden can issue an executive order to do so. Amir Abdullahian says if the U.S. has serious will, there's no need for all these negotiations at all. The top Iranian diplomat also says it's unacceptable for Iran if the U.S. wants to continue a large part of the sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump. Now, those sanctions hit Iran after Trump withdrew the U.S. from the nuclear deal in 2018, making the accord run into trouble. In April of this year, Iran and the remaining parties began talks on how to resolve these issues. We've spoken with geopolitical policy advisor Alexander Ozagan. He believes the U.S. and its European allies are doing all they can to remove any incentive for Iran to go back to the negotiating table. Let's take a listen.
In every negotiation, you need to have good faith. And the Europeans and the party of war in Washington are doing everything to for the Iranians not to have any incentive to come back to the negotiation table. A few days ago, me and Danny had an interview about Washington using the information they're getting from terrorist groups to use against Iran in terms of human rights violations. This happened a few days before what we are going into with the nuclear negotiations. They keep changing the goalposts. First, it was the French who wanted to dismantle the Iranian missile program, which is the only way the Iranians can protect themselves. Their outdated F-4, F-5, and F-14 jets are not going to protect them. So that was the goal. The Iranians are never going to negotiate over that. That falls under IRGC. And now they're talking about the drone program. Every advancement that Iran has made, they want to change. Basically, the goal is regime change and what they did to Libya. Just basically destroy the country from within, have different gangs running the country, the balkanization of not just the Middle East, but Iran in particular. That's what these people have in mind. And JCPOA was simply an excuse to bring the Iranians to the so-called negotiation table and just negotiate continuously. It's laughable. No country in the world would negotiate this way.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. A dispute between the UK and France over post-Brexit fishing rights is dragging on. London has now rejected Paris's claims that they have agreed to defuse the row. Well, the British government says it is up to France to make the first move. London also urged Paris to step away from threatening to block French ports to British vessels. France is angered by a decision from Britain and Jersey last month to deny fishing licenses to dozens of French boats. Paris has said the move was in breach of the Brexit deal. Now, tensions between the two European nations escalated on Wednesday. That's when France detained a British trawler and fined another in French waters. Paris also promised more retaliatory measures. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of London, Robert Carter. And out of Paris, Ramin Mazahiri. Well, wow. One's in London, one's in Paris. Guys, tell us what's going on. I mean, Robert, from your side of things, as far as the UK, what is being said?
Well, obviously, the big question is surrounding will anything be resolved before France's deadline for sanctions to be implemented against the UK? That, of course, would be quite an alarming development, especially because the UK is already under a lot of pressure due to other crises which have been plaguing our economy following Brexit, but also following the outbreak of COVID-19. So negative impacts have been felt, particularly this year. We've talked about in recent weeks, I'm sure even on Bulletin, about the long queues for petrol, the rising taxes that are coming into place, the budget review, which is likely to affect those who are already being heavily affected by the fact that their pound is being devalued, the fact that there are less job opportunities. So all sorts of problems are already affecting the British economy. Now it looks like that our European ally, so-called European ally France, might be slapping on some sanctions to punish Britain for the fishing dispute. And that, of course, could lead to a new round of crises and queues of ports and things like that leading up to Christmas. And again, COVID cases are on the rise again, so it's suspected that there'll be a major NHS crisis as well looming. So basically, France probably knows that the UK is in a bit of a weakened position in terms of having to deal with all of these various problems, and now they're trying to apply pressure on an issue which ultimately could put France in a very strong position in terms of facing off with this Brexiteer nationalistic country known as Britain just opposite its shores.
Well, let's cross over to Paris. So, I mean, your take, I mean, how likely is it really to happen that France will actually issue sanctions against the UK?
Extremely slim. This is really a lot of much ado about nothing, but there are some larger geopolitical and historical forces at play here. I think we should keep in mind that there is major dissent between the UK and the EU. The UK left the EU in Brexit, and that's not something that is done in 2 weeks. This is a multi-year process, and this is sort of the first time that we are seeing the reality that the UK is not really ready for more intensive customs checks. And now we are starting to see that it's not really France that is in the powerful position. It's that the EU, being the more powerful bloc, I'm nearly certain, the UK's largest foreign trade partner, that they have a lot more leverage in this situation. So this is part of this long-running Brexit issue. But the actual problem of a few dozen to a maximum of 200 fishing boats not getting their licenses, very possibly because they have been fishing illegally in UK waters, and they don't want to give up that paperwork, which would implicate them. This is not something that is going to affect the economies of 130 million combined people in France and the UK. So it's really sort of a very small issue. And then at the same time, it's an issue that plays very well for the nationalistic government of the UK. Boris Johnson does very well complaining and railing about the EU, and there was obviously a grassroots sentiment that agrees with him in the UK, which resulted in Brexit. At the same time, it's also something that makes Macron look strong here, less than 6 months into an election, and he's an extremely unpopular president, and he similarly does not want to talk about the economic crises that the UK is having, yes, but this is something that's happening all over the West, where they have embarked on these drastic lockdowns without any sort of socialistic types of measures to redistribute money as a result of it. So it's something that's being blown up out of proportion. It's the UK and France are not on the verge of you know total war again, but it's something that just reveals that Brexit is a major issue. It is going to cause logistical problems, and the UK is not weak because they have their sovereignty, but they are they do have to please their customer, the EU here. So lots of these different types of forces at play, fishing boats for these economies, infinite devil.
Okay, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Out of London, Robert Carter, and out of Paris, Ramin Mazahiri, on the ground there in Paris. Russia setting yet another record high in its daily COVID infections as the worst-hit country in Europe. Nearly 41,000 new infections there just over the past 24 hours. That raises the overall caseload to over 8.5 million. There have also been nearly 1,200 deaths during the same period. Now, it's the 12th consecutive day that Russia is reporting over 1,000 fatalities. The total tally now nearing 238,000. Officials are blaming a slow vaccination rollout for the worrying upward trend. The government is enforcing a workplace shutdown in the first week of November across the nation. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I've been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, today in this episode, I'm going to discuss domestic violence. And the previous episode also, I discussed domestic violence. I gave a definition of domestic violence, and I said that domestic violence is a reality, it's undeniable, and it is one of the evil phenomena that exist in our society. And of course, it's not particular to the Muslim community. Domestic violence exists everywhere. Some are the perpetrators of domestic violence, and others are obviously the victims. And when we talk of domestic violence, we usually mean that men are the people and the ones who are responsible for the domestic violence, and women are the victims, the children are the victims. They are the ones who suffer most in the family environment. Brothers and sisters, there is an ayah in the Quran. I read this ayah in the previous episode. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُونُوا قَوَامِينَ لِلَّهِ شُهَدَاءً بِالْقِسْطِ وَلَا يَجْمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ عَلَىٰ أَلَّا تَعْدِلُوا اِعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ إِنَّ اللَّهَ خَبِيرٌ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. Now look at this verse. This verse clearly indicates that we need to deal other people justly, and the hatred for other people should not make us turn away from justice. We need to fear Allah, and Allah is aware of what we do. This is verse 8 of chapter 5.
At this time, we have a short break, and then we'll listen to the continuation of the speech of Sheikh Javed Akbari. You're listening to For a Better Life from IRIB English Radio.
Now there's another verse. It is verse 135 of chapter 4. Believers, be maintainers of justice and witnesses of Allah, even though it is against yourself, your parents, or your kinsmen, whether he is rich or poor. Allah has more rights over both of them, over the parents and over your father and mother, over your children. So do not follow desires so that you are not just. If you twist or turn, Allah is aware of what you do. Dear brothers and sisters, we are talking about domestic violence. And domestic violence means, as I offer the definition of domestic violence, according to the dictionary, is the inflicting of physical injury by one family or household member on another household member or another family member. It is actually a repeated or habitual pattern of such behavior. So that was the definition, but we need to understand that in this time around, with some men committing violence against their wives, against their sisters, against the weaker members of the family, Now, hitting, sometimes even using force, sometimes doing acts which are inhuman. So, first of all, according to speaking from a religious perspective, speaking from a legal perspective, of course, it is not permissible for anyone to hit another person. It's not permissible for the man in the family to beat his wife, to hit his children in such a way that his act of beating leaves bruises or scars on the body of those people in his family. If a person hits another person on the face and his skin turns red, according to fiqh, according to Islamic jurisprudence, it is necessary for the person to give blood money. It is necessary for him to give diya, which has been translated into blood money or atonement, or there are different words which are used to translate diya, of course. So if a person hits someone on the face and his skin turns red, he should give 1.5 dinars to the victim. And 1 dinar is, of course, equal to 3.5 grams of gold. This is one. And if he beats him or her on the body and his body turns red, then, of course, he has to give half of the same amount. So on the face, he has to give 1.5 dinars. And then if he hits someone on the body and the body becomes red, he should give half of that amount to the victim as blood money. And of course, if the body turns green, the blood money is 3 dinars on the face, of course. If it is on the body, if the body turns green, then the blood money is 1.5. It is half of that. If it is half of the blood money of the face. And if the face turns black, the blood money is 6 dinars. And of course, it is half of it on the body.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Generally speaking, the blood money of the face is twice the blood money of the body. Now, as I told you, 1 dinar is equal to 3.5 grams of gold. Anything other than gold, according to many religious authorities, does not suffice as an obligatory precaution, and it's permissible, of course, to compromise on the diya amount. And this is what the religious authorities have said. And of course, those people who are in the habit of committing violence in the family, they should know that if they hit their wives or their children or anyone and in the family or anyone outside the family, then this is the amount of the atonement. This is the amount of the blood money which he should pay and he should give. In order to relieve himself of the responsibility. Otherwise, if he does not pay it, obviously then he is liable, he is responsible, and he is indebted to that person. Many religious authorities have said that men is not allowed to beat their wives. And of course, beating has been translated into something which we will discuss in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for this program. Inshallah, we listen to other episode of this program for a better life. Same time, same channel. Fi amanillah.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. All I need. Love is all I need.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell founded the Boy Scouts for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. God made men to be men, he wrote. Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers.
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, you see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. And this backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
Plain truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yeah!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on, and so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there, then why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate. Mm-hmm. They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well made. You can carry plenty of them on your person at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Brevik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Brevik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the Commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my life, I was ridiculed, always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-wee returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window, and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society. And toward the end of his own journal, Harris writes, everyone is always making fun of me because of how I look, how f***ing weak I am, and well, I will get you all back. I hate people, and they better f***ing fear me if they know what's good for them.
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in a Southern California hair salon shooting that left 8 people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. But we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II, the film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it. I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma, showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. A And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose six-year-old son Jesse was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
The program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood. But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.